This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, state visit and the president's bucket list, Donald Trump finally meets the Queen on a formal visit. The Tiananmen Square massacre is a no-go topic in Beijing, but AM finds in Australian suburbs with heavy Chinese populations, locals also tread very carefully.
The foreign people think that Chinese government just control everything, but in fact it's not really like that. We still have some freedom.
Literally you can find it on Chinese website. They are all blocked out. But the youngster, the teenagers, they don't know.
The sacking of Wallabies star Israel Folau for a social media post condemning gay relationships has sparked a court case and plenty of water cooler discussions. It's also spurred an already heated political debate about the level of protection for people of faith against discrimination. The Human Rights Commission is now stepping in with a plan to set out plain English guidelines to help employers and employees navigate their rights and protections. Here's political reporter Melissa Clark.
Sport, politics, religion and ethics, it's a heady mix. Folau's sacking has become the emblematic case of the tussle between protection of religious freedom and protection against discrimination and vilification. While it has prompted a debate about whether the balance of legal protections is right, Human Rights Commissioner Edward Santo says in the vast majority of cases, it shouldn't have to come down to a legal battle.
We understand that the law is an important protection, but we also want to provide practical guidance as to how to navigate some of the tricky issues that arise.
He's notified the Attorney General he'll be releasing guidelines to help employers and employees navigate such issues.
We're going to develop some resources that provide practical, plain English guidance on how our law protects freedom of thought, conscience and religion in Australian workplaces.
How long will it take you to develop these guidelines?
We'll work really hard to look at the material we've already developed we hope to perform this task over the next 2 to 3 months.
Yesterday, Liberal Senator Eric Abetz called on the Human Rights Commission and the Fair Work Commission to investigate Folau's sacking specifically.
I'm asking them for the interpretation of the law so that we can get a better understanding of what the current situation is.
And he wants clarification that religious beliefs can't be used as a basis for firing someone from a sports team.
This is an issue of where we draw the line in relation to people's freedoms. And I am one of those that would seek to draw the line to give as much expression to allow the individual as much expression as possible.
The coalition went to the federal election promising to introduce a new law to protect religious freedom, and it's already being drafted and is expected to be one of the early priorities of the Morrison government. Edward Santo says the Human Rights Commission supports stronger protections for freedom of religion, thought and conscience. But he's emphasising the need for everyone to be respectful as the first step.
We don't want people to have to go to the courts except as a last resort. What's much, much better is to have a good general understanding of how we've decided to be respectful of each other and to apply that in 99.99% of situations. And only in the really difficult situations then does things really escalate and you have to take your matter to court.
That is the Human Rights Commissioner Edward Santo ending that report by Melissa Clark. 30 years ago, China's leaders sent in tanks and armed soldiers to crush a six-week-long student protest calling for democratic reforms. Now the current leaders are doing their very best to make sure that no one on mainland China publicly marks the anniversary. The Tiananmen Square crackdown of 1989 has long been heavily censored, and some of today's students in Beijing have never even heard of it. Here's China correspondent Bill Birtles.
30 years ago, the student protesters who filled Tiananmen Square in the heart of Beijing mainly came from the campuses of the city's universities. Old footage reveals fresh-faced students speaking openly to international reporters.
Are you scared that the troops might come, that you might be hurt?
Me? I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. Because people are afraid of the force.
These days, things couldn't be more different. The square is so heavily secured that when AM tried to visit, we were stopped at a police checkpoint, surrounded by eight officers, and told foreign journalists can't visit without permission. We were then followed by four security agents on the subway across to the other side of town. And up on the university campuses in Beijing's northwest, many students are nervous and even fearful to talk about the anniversary. Some students ran away when we asked if they know the significance of June the 4th. Others, like this management student from one of Beijing's top universities, couldn't recognise the iconic Tank Man image from 1989.
I'm pretty sure I've never seen this picture, but I've maybe seen similar images.
A 19-year-old law student who didn't want us to use his name knew the Tank Man photo.
Yes, I've seen this photo. What's the purpose of publishing it in international media? There's really nothing I can say. I don't know what my friends know about it. We never talk about it.
A postgraduate student from Beijing's Renmin University told AM it wouldn't be good for her career prospects to talk about the anniversary.
The political environment here is getting tighter and tighter. I have a critical view, but I feel powerless to change things.
Several other students AM spoke to hadn't heard of the 1989 protests or weren't even aware of the sensitivity around the topic. But a 20-year-old accounting student from Beijing's University of Mining and Technology said while he wasn't sure exactly what happened, he believes what the government did was correct. He didn't want to do an interview, but said what he wants for China is different to what the students of 1989 wanted. Within mainland China, the history of the Tiananmen Square protests isn't completely censored. An internet search brings up a succinct government view of what happened, but no pictures or details, nor is there any mention of the anniversary in state media. As the snapshot of students shows, the censorship has largely worked. If today's generation of students know anything about the Tiananmen Square crackdown, it's to steer well clear of the topic. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for AM.
Following the massacre, Australia granted permanent residency visas to 42,000 Chinese students. Then Prime Minister Bob Hawke unilaterally made the decision to allow them to stay. Hurstville in Sydney South was transformed by the influx of new migrants. It now has the country's highest proportion of Chinese Australian residents. Gavin Coote reports.
It's a bustling evening in the heart of Hurstville, where the recent demolition of an old retail complex has paved the way for a new open plaza space. The suburb is often dubbed Sydney's real Chinatown, and it's undergone profound demographic change in recent decades. High school student Matthew Dang is tickling the ivories as part of a musical installation and inviting others to join in.
It's a sense of belonging to me because, you know, the Cantonese noodles and the dumplings, all of this stuff, it just tastes familiar to my hometown back in China.
With a new generation of students and professionals calling Australia home, what do they say about the Tiananmen Square crackdown 30 years on? Many in Hurstville were reluctant to discuss the topic with AM, with some quick to point out what they say is an anti-Chinese narrative in Australia's media. Sky is in her early 20s and wears an oversized hoodie to ward off the cold. Her parents live in a small regional town outside of Beijing. She's in Sydney studying a foundation program with the aim of eventually studying IT at university.
I always come here like for the education. Also, it's near the sea. I've never seen the sea before.
She says many Australians are misinformed about the actions of the Chinese government at the time of the student uprising. She says the belief that Chinese government censorship has prevented people her age from learning about the event is wrong.
It's okay if we just talk about it, but it seems like the foreign people think that Chinese government just control everything. They don't allow us to talk about this, talk about that. But in fact, it's not really like that. We still have some freedom to talk about what we think.
Overlooking the plaza in Hurstville is Patrick Luck's sporting goods store, where he's busy restringing tennis rackets. He's from Hong Kong and is glad the event is marked there. but says it remains an off-limits topic for many in the Chinese community in Hurstville.
I think it's unfortunate. I think we should learn from the lesson.
Yeah. And do you think many locals around here are open to talking about it, or do you think a lot of people still maybe don't know it happened or don't want to talk about it happening?
I don't think the kid or even the Australian-born Chinese or the Chinese community in Sydney, they will talk about it. Yeah, because literally you can't find it on Chinese website. They are all blocked out. Yeah, I don't think anyone, well, the youngster, the teenagers, they don't know about it.
Other Chinese Australians didn't want to talk about Tiananmen Square, but say ongoing understanding between the two countries is important.
Respect is very important, that respect each other and know the culture each other.
I do think that there's definitely room of improvement, both in China and in Australia.
Chinese Australian residents there speaking with Gavin Coote. You're listening to AM. It's 11 past 8. The Federal Health Minister, Greg Hunt, is convening a roundtable of about 20 mental health experts and interest groups in Melbourne today to discuss suicide prevention. The government committed more than $730 million to mental health in the April budget, and the Productivity Commission's also investigating what impact it has on society and the economy, but that report is not due until May next year. Professor Patrick McGorry is the Executive Director of Origin, the National Centre of Excellence in Youth Mental Health. He'll be at the meeting and he joined me earlier. Patrick McGorry, what should come from today's roundtable?
Well, it's very heartening that the Prime Minister and the Health Minister, Greg Hunt, have made such a strong public commitment, particularly to youth mental health and a zero suicide target. So I think a serious discussion about the next phase of reform in mental health care in Australia is what I'm hoping will come out of today's meeting.
Data shows that suicide rates aren't falling. They're plateauing in some areas, and in some areas the rate's rising. What's Australia doing wrong?
It's a very good question. I don't think we really know the answer to that totally. Suicide is caused by a complex mix of factors, but what we're not doing is responding with a proactive and expert healthcare system that can really help people who are obviously right on the edge and are reaching out for help. Many, many of these people are being turned away still.
In Indigenous communities, it's the picture is far worse. I think 79 people have taken their lives so far this year, including about 20 children. Experts say going back about 60 years ago, suicide was quite rare in Indigenous communities, and now it's not. Why has that happened?
Well, it has to be due to social and economic factors, doesn't it? Cultural factors. Something has happened in Indigenous communities over that time, if that's true. I don't know that is true. Suicide's not always measured accurately, but if that were true, it would really point to very substantial social changes driving this terrible epidemic, really, is what you have to call it.
There's been something like, I think, 34 statutory reviews into mental health since about 2006. Do public policy experts need more inquiries into this issue and ideas on how to tackle it, or are the answers there already?
Oh, well, look, I've been working in public mental health system for 35 years. I think we do know what to do, generally speaking, at least from a mental health care point of view. But I think the value of inquiries, of the gravitas of the Productivity Commission and the Victorian Royal Commission, which I'm personally centrally involved with, I think that they have a number of advantages over the sort of inquiries that have happened so far. And that is that you can mobilise a public consensus behind what needs to be done. It'll become obvious to every level of society what actually needs to be done to address these problems. And I think they're solvable. I think we shouldn't think of it as a wicked problem. When you've got such serious levels of underinvestment and also dismantling of things that work, which has actually happened at state government level around Australia, it's inevitable you're going to see this serious problem. It's not just deaths. It's blighted lives. It's wasted potential. It's people languishing when they should be flourishing. And all of these things are possible if we had the same level of investment. We invest about 6 or 7% of the health budget, and the problem is about a 14 to 15% problem in terms of its share of the healthcare burden. So we're spending between a third and a half of what we need to spend, and we're not spending it in the right ways. We're spending it way too much at the bottom of the cliff, if I can put it that way.
How would you characterise the problem of mental health now nationally, and how is it how important is it that issues like long-term unemployment, poverty and homelessness are addressed in crafting new approaches to tackling this?
Well, if we look at other non-communicable diseases like heart disease and cancer, where we have made major gains in the last two or three decades, what have they done? Well, they've addressed primary prevention, the things you just mentioned, the causes of the problem, the things that are probably making the issue worse. They're also investing in early intervention, early diagnosis. That's an absolute premium in illnesses like heart disease and cancer. And then they make sure once they've got people well, they keep them well. We do none of those things in mental health, really. And the easiest thing to do first, because obviously tackling poverty is a huge challenge, the easiest thing to do first is build accessible entry portals, which we have done to some extent, like with Headspace. That's been a success in getting people into the system at the first base. But then we don't build on it. And if we get people well, we just wait for them to get sick again. We don't do that in cancer. We don't do that in heart disease. So if we want to really reduce mortality and improve outcomes, we've got to do all three of those things.
New Zealand's just adopted the policy of putting a frontline medical health worker in every GP clinic. If that works, should Australia consider adopting that approach?
Well, I'd say we've done that to some extent with better access and with Headspace and these sorts of primary care initiatives. The entry point is actually not bad for mild cases, the early stage, you could probably say. What we haven't done is what we call the missing middle. We have not looked after people with moderate to severe conditions who are too complex for that initial, in Headspace we call it the thin green line. Beyond that, there's very little for people until they are in life-threatening situations when they end up in emergency departments and half of them or more get turned away.
Like you say, Headspace can deal with mild cases, but chronic cases, there's a question mark over that. Most of these clinics are 9-to-5. There's not complete transparency over waiting lists for Headspace. Is that really the answer?
I think, what we put to both sides of politics in the federal election was something called Headspace Plus. I mean, I don't really care what we call it, but it's something to address the more complex cases who need a longer period of care, who need more expert care, and that has not been done yet. I'm really hoping the re-elected coalition government will look at that. They did actually commit to something in that space for adults through the adult community mental health hubs, which we're going to be discussing with Minister Hunt. So there is a slow recognition that this missing middle must be dealt with, and that will turn off the tap that's just flooding into emergency departments every single day, every single night, of people with more serious mental illnesses who have nowhere else to go.
Patrick McGorry, thanks for talking to AM.
Thanks very much, Sarah.
And Professor McGorry is the Executive Director of Origin, the National Centre of Excellence in Youth Mental Health. If pomp and ceremony are what Donald Trump and his family wanted, they'd surely be happy with their first of a three-day visit to the UK. The Queen turned on the full ceremonial welcome for the President overnight, culminating in a much-awaited state banquet where Mr Trump and Queen Elizabeth took their seats at a white tie and tiara affair in Buckingham Palace. But it hasn't all been pageantry and gold carriages. President Trump showed his standard disdain for diplomatic niceties by providing his own commentary on the trip via a string of angry tweets. Chief Foreign Correspondent Philip Williams reports from London.
The big guns for the big gun. Donald Trump was in town, so too thousands of extra police and kilometres of barricades to keep the uninvited well away. Instead of wrangling London's traffic, Donald Trump and wife Melania literally travelled above it all in Marine One, the presidential chopper, the first couple delivered to the Buckingham Palace backyard for the full ceremonial welcome. But even before he'd landed in Britain, President Trump was busy in his own undiplomatic way, making clear his intense dislike for London Mayor Sadiq Khan, tweeting Khan was a stone-cold loser who should focus on crime in London, not me. The London Mayor was having none of that.
President Trump, if you're watching this, your values and what you stand for are the complete opposite of London's values and the values in this country.
Britain's Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, was left explaining what that was all about.
Well, he is a very controversial president, and we've all got used to that over the last 2 years, and there are no visits from President Trump that don't have unexpected moments.
There were protests outside Buckingham Palace and angry arguments between the president's supporters and detractors. Next day, we'll focus more on politics. He'll meet the Prime Minister, Theresa May, who's about to become an ex-PM. She may well not want to hear his strident views on Brexit or his support for Prime Ministerial aspirant Boris Johnson. Deep differences on Iran and Chinese communication giant Huawei are unlikely to be settled before President Trump rejoins the Royal Circle on Wednesday in Portsmouth for the 75th commemoration of the D-Day landings. So far, the Trump family's London trip has gone to script. Pictures taken, royal hand shaken. This is Philip Williams in London reporting for AM.
And our Europe correspondent Sam Hawley has been watching the banquet. She joined me earlier. Sam, the formal dinner's finally been held. Was everyone on their best behaviour?
Well, they certainly were, Sabra. It was a very regal affair. Many tiaras were out for the evening. President Trump, of course, the guest of honour at this event hosted by the Queen. Now, both the Queen and President Trump spoke to the gathering of about 170 people at that state banquet. They spoke of the importance of the alliance, the close and long-standing relationship, and they both really focused on the shared sacrifice ahead of the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings. And let's hear what Donald Trump had to say a short time ago at Buckingham Palace.
She has embodied the spirit of dignity, duty and patriotism that beats proudly in every British heart. On behalf of all Americans, I offer a toast to the eternal friendship of our people, the vitality of our nations, and to the long-cherished and truly remarkable reign of Her Majesty the Queen.
Donald Trump there. And Sam, did the President and Queen seem to enjoy themselves?
Well, I think so. Of course, the day was full of a lot of pomp and ceremony. Donald Trump was treated to all the trimmings that go with a state visit. And of course, Sabra, he's only the third sitting US president in recent times that has actually been given this honour. We saw George W. Bush also receive a state visit and Barack Obama. And so there's been many things throughout the day relating to that visit. And yes, I think they did enjoy themselves at this dinner, of course. And the Queen also spoke to that gathering. Let's hear from her.
Visits by American presidents always remind us of the close and long-standing friendship between the United Kingdom and the United States. And I'm so glad that we have another opportunity to demonstrate the immense importance that both our countries attach to our relationship.
Her Majesty the Queen, and before that, our Europe correspondent, Sam Hawley. With inflation below the Reserve Bank target, unemployment on the rise, and the economy slowing, just about every market economist thinks the Reserve Bank Board will cut the official interest rate today. But not everyone thinks following economic theory is the best way to kickstart confidence, especially with rates already very low. Businessman Graham Bradley, the chairman of HSBC Australia, Energy Australia and GrainCorp, is going against the pack, and he thinks there's a chance the Reserve Bank will keep its powder dry this afternoon. Mr. Bradley is speaking here with senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
I know most commentators and economists are saying that a rate cut seems very likely. My view is the bank will be reluctant to cut rates. It doesn't have much firepower left in case Australia were to get into a much worse economic position than we're in at the moment. So I think there are reasons why the Reserve Bank might continue its policy of being cautious about taking rates up or down.
Money markets are factoring in a close to 100% chance that the Reserve Bank Board might cut it, but do you think there's an outside chance they might hold back at this meeting?
Well, nearly 100% of polls and commentators thought Labor would win the election a couple of weeks ago, so I'm not sure that the economists always get these things right. But if the bank does cut, It will signal that it's seen some private data that's not necessarily in the public domain that suggests the economy is weaker than the unemployment figures would suggest, for example.
A cut this afternoon would take the cash rate to 1.25%, and that could be the start of an aggressive cutting cycle. If that does happen, do you see risks with that?
I do. We'll already be in negative interest rate territory, and we'll be heading even lower, because these movements are not so important in themselves, but what they signal about the direction of future movements of interest rates. And the beginning of a down cycle would suggest we're heading into rather difficult economic territory. I don't believe that the evidence supports that at the moment.
So you think that the Reserve Bank should really keep its powder dry for something that could be a really serious economic shock, like a hard economic landing in China or a ratcheting up in tensions between the United States and Iran, for example?
Yes, well, we're already seeing the international trade tensions affect parts of our economy. For example, coal boats are being slowed up in getting unloading in China. We're seeing China rejecting Australian barley. So there are implications of these trade tensions already affecting the economy, and it's possible they could get worse.
The housing correction has dampened consumer spending, and banks have tightened up lending standards in the wake of the Banking Royal Commission. But with the outlook for lower interest rates, is there a risk that borrowers might start leveraging up again if they have access to cheaper money and push real estate prices up?
Well, there is that risk. I don't think 0.25% is going to make much difference. I think what will make a difference is banks starting to lend more freely after they've digested the changes in their policies that they needed after the Hayne Royal Commission.
That's businessman Graham Bradley, and he's speaking there with our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. The first large group of refugees has been released from the camp in Syria that was established for ISIS family members. About 800 people, mostly women and children, were allowed to leave the vast Al Hol camp, which is also home to a group of Australians. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Adam Harvey.
Kurdish authorities say the Syrian women and children are not considered a security risk and have been released into the care of Arab tribal leaders from the area around Raqqa. It's expected to be the first of a series of mass releases of Syrian and Iraqi citizens over coming weeks. They're mostly IS family members who were evacuated to Al Hol earlier this year as the extremist group lost the last piece of its so-called caliphate. The camp currently holds 73,000 people, including at least 20 Australians. One Syrian woman, Anas, is returning to the former IS capital of Raqqa. I thank God because I'm going back home and we will be well taken care of. We got rid of Al Hol. We were living in a swamp where we felt thirsty and hungry. It was terrible. These women aren't turning their back on IS. Safa Mumin is another returnee. I'm happy to be released, but I hope that the state is back, that it will rule us back again. But why, she's asked. We were happier under God's Sharia. The Islamic State will remain and it will even extend. One of the officials assisting with the release, Farouk Al-Mashi, said he had high expectations for the women who were returning to live in Kurdish-controlled Syria. With the help of women, we hope to change the extremist terrorist mind into a fair Islamic mind that believes in peace and the peaceful living in communities. Anas was asked how she'd fare living under the rule of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. I will not mingle with them and will not have to interact with them. I will stay at home and shut up. I don't want to have to do anything with the Democrats or their forces. About 10,000 foreigners remain in Al Hol, including the Australians. UN spokesman Hedin Haldorsen repeated a call for Western nations to help bring their citizens home.
The UN is calling on member states and has been doing so. We're calling on states of origin of third country nationals in Al Hol camp to fulfill their responsibility to their citizens and find future solutions through repatriation, reintegration and or prosecution, if that is the case, when and if applicable. And that, of course, all needs to take place in line with human rights standards.
It's expected that more IS family members will be released after this week's Eid celebrations. This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for AM.
That is AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
It's been 30 years since the Chinese government massacred hundreds, if not thousands, of its own citizens who were demanding democracy in Tiananmen Square. But the topic is still totally off limits in China.
So how much have people forgotten, and how much do they just pretend to forget?
The tactics of suppressing a massacre. Does it work, and can it last?
That's The Signal. You can hear us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.